But the most important thing when you're doing live sound is to make sure that you've just got gobs and gobs of headroom. You're never trying to hit the instrument hard because you can't hear yourself that well. Right there, you've lost the plot of everything you're trying to achieve tone-wise with your right hand. I you know, you'll see on that video, I don't know if it's like the 2 412s or the 4 410s, but it's a lot of speaker mass always behind me with the Arista. I'm not using in-ears, it's open monitoring. I'm standing right in front of the rig. I'm playing so light. That's what allows the instrument to speak, the purpose, the why it was built.
Welcome to episode 119 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. What's up, folks? Welcome to episode 119 of the Bass Shed Podcast. First and foremost, I want to thank everybody that attended the Eric Curtis Masterclass on March 3rd. That was wonderful. I had a great time. I got a lot of messages afterwards that a lot of other people enjoyed it. And thank you all for your attendance online. And thank you for everybody. Thank you to everybody that came in person. Everybody online and in person showed up with great questions that really steered the event and kind of the flow of the conversation with Eric Curtis in a new direction. That was wonderful. Eric Curtis brought some wonderful wisdom and insight, and what I loved about the overview of what he had to say is he was talking about music from the inside out. He was talking a lot about the personal connection he has in bass playing and in songwriting and in production, and how that comes out and where that comes out. And we kind of dug into that. You know, we did spend some time talking about the technical things of preamps and compressors and stuff like that, but it really went to an internal place, which I love. It was a fantastic event, and thank you again to everybody that showed up. For those that may have missed the Eric Masterclass, and if you're interested, it still exists on YouTube. You can also see it at thebassshedacademy.org. Go to Masterclasses. It's there. It's free. Everything's free. Go check it out. The first part is about an hour long, and the second part is about a half hour long. So, you know, it's hopefully you'll watch both. It's a commitment, but it was a great time. I had a wonderful time. Thank you again to Eric. Thank you to everybody that came out. Again, if you'd like to check it out, The Bass Shed on YouTube, or stop by thebassshedacademy.org. All right, in other news, we have some things coming your way from the Bass Shed Academy. Jerry Jamont and myself are finalizing a transcription book. Jerry came over to the studio, it seems like a month ago, but also Christmas seems like it was 5 years ago. Technically, there was a Christmas 5 years ago. Not exactly what I meant, though. You know what I mean? Like, time is feeling weird. Anyways, he did come over to the studio. He brought a hard drive with a bunch of tracks he had played on that, you know, are some of his personal favorites. And we listened through those, and Jerry hand-selected these 5 tunes for a transcription book we're putting together. 15 tunes in total. There's more information about the book at thebassshedacademy.org/transcriptions. We are making it available for pre-order. This is actually a funny little thing about the book. The book is coming out, finally, you know, all in its totalness, March 22nd. I didn't know that March 22nd was actually Jerry's birthday when we decided to do this. So that's kind of cool. It'll be coming out on his birthday. And so for the pre-order, use the promo code BIRTHDAY20 to save 20% on pre-ordering of the Jerry Jamont transcription book. On the show is Brian Beller. Brian Beller has maintained a multifaceted career as a bassist, composer, solo artist, and clinician for over 25 years, earning his reputation as a uniquely talented yet supremely tasteful team player for instrumentally minded artists. He is a founding member of the Aristocrats, which is one of the hottest acts in rock fusion today. Their 2019 release, You Know What, debuted at number 2 on the Billboard Jazz Chart. The Aristocrats also just released a new album titled Duck that Brian will speak about. Brian Beller has been Joe Satriani's touring bassist since 2013 and also tracked Satriani's complete 2022 album, The Elephants of Mars. He was Steve Vai's choice for the 2009 CD-DVD Where the Wild Things Are. And he also toured and recorded in the band Death Clunk. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. A tongue-in-cheek extreme metal band born of the hit Cartoon Network Adult Swim. Brian Beller has been a musical partner of freak genius guitar player Mike Neely, who played with Frank Zappa, for over 20 years and 10 albums. In addition, Beller's solo album catalog includes a 2003 release titled View, a 2008 release titled Thanks in Advance, and a 2011 release titled Wednesday Night Live. Brian has also released an instructional DVD, all of which have received widespread acclaim. In addition, right? Like, on top of all that, Brian has also been a contributing editor for Bass Player Magazine and a former VP of SWR Bass Amps. Brian and I chatted a bit while we sorted out some audio-visual things. He told me he was in his hotel room at the time when we recorded this, while on tour with G3, which is the tour with Joe Satriani, Steve Vai, and Eric Johnson. We chat about that tour. We chat about his latest release with the Aristocrats. We chat about his early days in music. Obviously, we discuss bass gear and some other fascinating topics. I had known of Brian Beller for quite a while, and it was great to connect with him. And here it is. Here's my talk with electric bassist, composer, clinician, and solo artist, Brian Beller. Let's start there, man. How long is the tour? You're doing the G3 tour with Satriani, Vai, and Eric Johnson.
Yeah, this is the big reunion tour. You know, this was the original lineup back in 1996. Right. First time they've gotten back together and done this. And, you know, I'm in Joe Satriani's band, and I have been for the last 10 years. And so the way it works is Steve will do a set, and then Eric will do a set, and then Joe does a set. And then Joe's rhythm section is the rhythm section for the jam when everybody comes back up. So I get to play with everybody, which is super cool.
Nice. Now I know you've tracked and you've done records with Steve Vai. Have you done records with Eric Johnson also?
I have not worked with Eric Johnson before this. So this is
okay. Really- oh, before this first tour, or this tour you're on now?
Yeah, this is it. This is the first time I've worked with Eric.
Okay.
He's amazing. You know, he's a really unique artist.
Yeah. I remember listening to a lot of those specific guitar players and guitar players of that, whatever you want to call it. You know. Back in the day when they were doing it. But I want to talk about a couple things, man. I got the press release about your group, the Aristocrats, that I absolutely want to talk about because you guys have a record coming out in about a week, a little over a week.
February 16 is the drop date. I'm not sure when this is going to post, but February 16. And the album is called Duck.
And I want to talk about that concept because that sounds – I want you to explain that concept because I read about it. I'm like – that's hilarious. I want to hear about it from him, though. But for perspective, you started as an upright player, like way back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
A zillion years ago. I mean, not to age you out of anything, but when your first in to the bass was playing orchestral music in the school orchestra.
Yeah, when I was 10 years old, yeah.
Yeah. So that would be, what is that, fourth, fifth grade?
Yeah, around there. And I did it for 3 years, and then I wanted to switch to electric.
Now, you were inspired by groups like Rush and Zeppelin and Metallica. How did you get hip to those groups? Were they on the radio? Is that how you found out about them? Did you find out from friends? Was it being played around the house?
No, I was the oldest of sibling in my house. I didn't have older cousins. I didn't have anybody. My parents, God bless them, they're wonderful, but they were kind of square. Mom's a teacher. They had all the Beatles albums. Okay. And they had the first Doors album, but like a lot of baby boomers of their age, like the hard dividing line was they had Abbey Road, but they never bought Led Zeppelin 1. You know what I mean? So that was it. And so I found out about all that stuff from what we would now call, you know, classic rock, but then it was album oriented rock, AOR, you know, the regular FM rock stations in the New York area, PLJ, WNEW. And they were always playing Zeppelin and always playing Rush. And I went out and I went to the record stores and got them, mostly cassettes then. Sure. I had a couple albums on vinyl. Early Pink Floyd. I was a huge Pink Floyd fan. The Wall was okay. The album I ever owned. And Metallica, you know, I used to hang out in the back of the school with all the metalheads and everything. And you know, everyone was listening to Kiss and Motley Crue and rap, whatever. And then one day someone brought a Metallica cassette and put it on. And half the metalheads in the back scene there were like, wow, that is amazing. What is that? And the other half were like, that sounds terrible. It sounds like noise. What the hell is that? Yeah. Of course, we all know what happened after that. But I was the first group. I was super into it. And I ran. I actually lived just a town over from, and I don't know how many people here are into their kind of, you know, 80s thrash metal history here, but I lived a town over from Clark, New Jersey, which means that I was able to ride my bicycle to Rock and Roll Heaven, where this had a store, and it was the only place you could get a Metallica cassette back then. And I had no idea. I was like walking into like what would become like a hallowed place in that history. But yeah, that's where I got my first Metallica cassette.
Okay. Okay. And so now you shift from upright to electric around what, 12, 13, right?
13. Yeah. Yeah.
Because of these groups, what are you just learning the records? Did you have any formal training, or did you get into like some local music store lessons type of thing?
I took a classical piano lesson starting at age 8. So
okay.
I learned the whole kind of basic theory, circle of fifths, majors, minor keys, everything. And I was a undisciplined classical piano player, but I have a really sharp ear. That was something I was gifted with, thank God. And I kept working on it because it was fun to figure out how to play regular rock songs on piano. So I used to like play these arrangements of like, you know, Rush songs. Like I had a hacked out version of like La Via Strangiata. I used to play the piano, or Pink Floyd, Nobody's Home, which is very pretty and has an actual, you know, Nobody Home, a real piano arrangement. Even Zeppelin tunes, you know, I'd sit there like, you know, go boo, 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 boo on the piano.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the funny thing is so by the time I started upright bass, I had that background. Then, you know, I read a lot of bass clef. Mm-hmm. Then when I wanted to play electric bass, I kind of went the other way. I wanted to play electric bass in a school jazz band. And the school orchestra teacher was like, well, if you want to do that, you have to keep playing string bass in the orchestra.
Right, right.
And I didn't want to do that anymore, but he didn't have another
blackmail
upright bass player. And I was like, well, I don't want to do that. Well, he's like, well, you have to. And I was like, I don't have to do shit. I quit ball. And that's what I did. And so I just went off on my own with the electric bass, and I taught myself basically how to play by ear.
Okay.
I didn't really take a formal lesson on electric bass until I was 17 with a jazz guitar teacher a few times over, but I just kind of learned on my own because I already knew theory and I could put the notes on the neck, and I just started learning Zeppelin tunes and Rush tunes and, you know, Metallica tunes to the extent that I could play them.
Nice. So
that's how it started for me. But the truth is when I was a teenager, I was playing more piano than I was electric bass because you could play whole songs on there. So I played bass in a couple of local bands, but I was really playing a lot of piano. Then I got to Berklee College of Music and realized these piano players that are here are like completely another league. And I really want to play bass anyway in a band. So that's when I got really serious about bass. Not until I was like 18.
Did you go to Berklee as a piano player, or did you go as a bass player?
Bass player.
Okay. And so what were you doing with the bass from that time, from 13 and learning the tunes off the records? Were you playing in little pickup bands? Were you jamming in the garages?
There really was not much going on around where I lived in Westfield, New Jersey. It was a bedroom community of New York City. It was very white collar. It was not a fertile ground for the kind of music that I wanted to play. Mm-hmm. There was one local band that was popular in the high school. They played a lot of REM.
God bless
them. And, you know, there was a kind of a happening scene a few towns over, 20, 30 minutes away in Morristown, New Jersey. The Brian Tischy, the drummer, was there. John DeServio, bass player, was there. He went on to become the bass player for Black Label Society. And there was a few other players here who went on to be pros, but nowhere near where I lived in New Jersey, 30 minutes away, might as well have been 5 hours away.
Mm-hmm.
So I just really kind of stuck to myself and was kind of a bedroom player. I mean, I was in one band. We didn't do much.
Yeah. What kept you kind of inspired? Just going through other records and learning a bunch of tunes off records, and that was your.
I was a self starter. I could really go down a rabbit hole on my own. Yeah, I had a lot. By that time, I was listening to a lot of Yes, And I was even starting to get into like Chick Corea
Okay.
and all sorts of other rock. Yeah, I you know, and the Beatles. I love the Beatles.
Sure.
I play a lot of Beatles on the piano.
Yeah.
And bass.
So then at Berkeley, because you're a self-starter, and I'm sure at Berkeley you run into a bunch of people that are looking for someone to get them across the finish line, and they're not self-motivated or don't have kind of an inner drive. Did you graduate Berkeley, or did you just be like, this is bullshit?
No, I, as a matter of fact, despite the fact that I was a self-starter, when I got to Berkeley, I realized that same people my age had been in a, you know, performing arts high school in Germany since the age of 12.
Right, right.
Those already people, yeah. Like solo over giant steps as a freshman. And I was right. Like, oh, I have catching up to do. So right. It actually kicked my ass.
Okay.
I spent another year and a half kind of locked in a practice room, catching up and getting to where I thought I needed to be before I started performing out at Berkeley in my sophomore year.
Okay. Okay. Now I know you've written a lot for Bass Magazine also.
Bass Player Magazine. Yeah.
Bass Player Magazine. Yeah. Man, all the names are getting. So Bass Player Magazine is now Bass Magazine, and Bass Player is like a thing in UK now, but you were on the OG. You were on the OG, yes. Bass Player Magazine.
Yeah. Which of course was those things that was forever for 25 years. Bass Player Magazine was the only real bass magazine.
Right. I agree. I mean, I've been writing for what is now Bass Magazine with Chris Gesey and John Diora, and I love.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, those are the guys who a lot, especially Chris Gesey.
Yeah, Chris,
he's all the way back.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And I love being a part of that because those guys were the guys. Those were exactly. The original guys.
It was great. I knew, Jim Roberts, the original editor.
Yeah.
Who gave me one of my first breaks. It was really great. It's a long story. I'm going to get into it, but.
As a writer or as a performing bass player?
Both.
Okay.
I mean, like, you know, we were, okay, 30-second version, 1995, I'm new in town, I just got the gig with Dweezil Zappa, and I'm playing with Mike Keneally, I'm young, I'm 23, 24, Fender was just starting to make active basses for the first time. Mm-hmm. They wanted to make an active five-string jazz bass. Okay. They were bringing in players, you know, to test them out. And they asked Mike Keneally if he knew any bass players, and they said, well, Brian, I'll bring in Brian. So they brought me in, and they played me a couple, gave me a couple prototypes, and I played through them, and you know, he just worked my way through them and played a couple different things. I was so young. I mean, I didn't know what really how to get different sounds. I just did my thing.
What year was this again?
95, 94. Okay. And so the people in the room, I didn't know who any of these people were. People in the room were Mark Kendrick, who went on to be a Fender Master Builder. John Sir, who was working at Fender at the time before he founded his own guitar company.
Sure.
And Dan Smith, who was like head of Fender R&D for And then there was this guy in the back who was just taking pictures. So I'm just like playing for these guys, you know, doing my thing for 20 minutes. And they're like, all right, well, thank you very much. And I had just had a Tobias, my main instrument, stolen out of my apartment.
Oh.
I didn't really have my own great bass. Now, the guy in the back who had been taking pictures walks up and he goes, hey, I never heard of you. What's your name? And I said, I'm Brian Beller. He's who you play with. I said, I play with Dweezil Zappa and Mike Keneally. I said, who are you? He goes, I'm Jim Roberts. I'm the editor of Bass Player Magazine. I was like, ugh. I mean, like, if the editor of Bass Player Magazine was sitting in the back while I was doing that, I would have froze, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he goes, well, I'd like to do an article on you. I don't think anybody's done any press on you yet. I'm like, okay. Meanwhile, the head of Fender Artist Relations, Mark Wittenberg, was sitting right next to him. And he goes, do you have an endorsement deal? I'm like, no. He's like, do you want one?
Yeah. Yes. Before you do this interview with the magazine, talk about my bases.
it all happened in like a minute. So
that's amazing.
And then I told Jim, as he got to know me better, that I had a passion for writing, and he asked me to do a guest article in 97. I did one. And then eventually they gave me the back page for like 3 years. I got to write whatever I wanted on the back page, as long as it had something to do with the bass.
Yeah.
Like 18 issues, which was really wonderful.
That's killer, man.
And then I went on to do regular writing for them, CD reviews, feature articles, a couple of cover stories, like Chris Wolstenholm, from Muse, Christian McBride, Justin Chancellor from Tool. I mean, I got to meet a lot of great guys.
Yeah. Besides those ones you just mentioned, any major standout connections that maybe you're interviewing somebody and you have to, you know, kind of pinch yourself like, oh man, I can't believe I'm talking to this guy right now.
I got to talk to John Patitucci because he was one of my heroes.
Sure.
I mean, there were a couple guys like that. But right now I'm kind of blanking, you know, because there were just so many.
Right.
There were so many people I got to talk to. Oh, well, I got to, you know, get in depth with Victor on a couple of things that he was doing, which was amazing. Even though I wasn't like deep into Victor's thing when I was a learning player and I'm not an extended technique player, it was still great to talk to these guys about like what it was that they were really doing.
We'll be back right after this.
Get featured on the Base Shed podcast. Yeah, folks, that's right. Hit me up. Let me know what news of yours you would like me to share. Whatever you have going on. You just came out with a new album. Let me know about it. You just came out with a new single. Let me know about it. I will talk about whatever news you have to share right here in the middle of the episode on the Base Shed podcast. Stop by thebaseshed.com/get featured. Check it out. Hit me up. Let me know. I'd love to hear what everybody is up to. All right, all the features on the Base Shed podcast are brought to you by the International Society of Bassists. Stop by www.isbworldoffice.com for more news. It is a great resource for not only double bassists, but electric bassists as well. Stop by and see what's going on. What is going on is March 17th, Dr. Matt Hare will be performing on the world-famous Kar Kusevitsky bass. More information about that event at thebaseshedacademy.org. Also, this coming Saturday, I will be doing a live stream with Dr. Hare at one of the rehearsals for that concert. He will be performing on the bass that day, so I'm going to stop by, we're going to hang, and we're going to share that with all of you.
Excellent, sir.
Let's pivot to the Aristocrats. Now, I got sent a couple videos. I got sent an animated thing of your new record, Duck, which there is an animation component to this album.
Right.
Which I'd like you to explain. And then I got some live footage of you guys in Japan. Now, your sound on that live recording, it was just a YouTube video that I got, but your sound is crushing.
Thank you.
Like, your sound is super clear. It's really fat. Like, you're playing a PJ in it. You probably know exactly what bass it was. All I saw was that it was a Fender PJ. I think it was a Fender PJ.
It's a Mike Lowell PJ.
Okay. Okay. But man, it was like just enough J, just enough P. Like it was, you had a pedal board. On your website is a breakdown of what's on your pedal board. What is your typical signal chain before we get into the band?
Well, this is longer than we really have time to go over.
I
have done what I need to do in order to be able to play some of the complicated music that I've been hired to play, and that's all fine.
Mm-hmm.
I can get around on the instrument. It's fine. I would never advertise myself as like a, you know, technique first player. I like songs. I'm playing an instrumental fusion rock band, so that's what I'm doing. But the thing that I've gone really, really down deep the rabbit hole on is tone, getting live tone, getting studio tone, but especially getting live tone.
Yeah.
And so always choose the right instrument for the task. That's a PJ. It's got a rosewood fingerboard, alder body. So it's warm and chocolatey sounding and kind of vintagey. And it's good for the particular song that I was playing it on. But I also have a bright Michael Cole 5-string, a modern 5. It's got a maple fingerboard, ash body, maple top, just designed to be a brightness machine. Mm-hmm. And when I say bright, I don't mean bright like really sweet, super fusion bright, like, you know, maybe I don't want to slur anybody's brand or anything like that, but like, you know, the Sadowskis can be very, very smooth and a little fusiony. And there's other basses that are out there like that. Some of the coffee table basses, what we'll call them, you know, really, really wonderful instruments. But the thing that I love about Mike Lowell is that it's a boutique small shop. But what they're doing is they're cranking out instruments that have like real kind of like great upper mids. And so that if I wanted to be like a rock fusion, a rock instrumental player, I can add overdrive to it. It really grinds, it really growls. So that's one of my other main instruments. And then I have a third instrument, which is a signature called a BBMF5, which is really kind of going after that modern Spectre-y kind of sound.
Okay.
Because I have Spectres and I love them, but physically they're a little difficult for me to play live. They don't sit the way I like.
Mm-hmm.
So I got Mike Lowell to make one that was a copy, essentially, of a Alex Webster signature, except it's not really a copy because Michael instruments are bolt-on, Spectres are neck-throughs.
Right.
But it's got alder body, maple top, ebony fingerboard, EMG BQC preamp, and EMG 40 DC pickups. And it gives you this kind of very punchy mid-range, very kind of compressy with a glassy high end. It really cuts through mixes and everything like that. So, I mean, I could talk about this for hours about every one of the tools and all that. But the most important thing when you're doing live sound is to make sure that you've just got gobs and gobs of headroom. You're never trying to hit the instrument hard because you can't hear yourself that well.
Right.
Right there, you've lost the plot of everything you're trying to achieve tone-wise with your right hand. So I, you know, you'll see on that video, I don't know if it's like the two 412s or the four 410s, but it's a lot of speaker mass always behind me with the Arista.
Right.
I'm not using in-ears. It's open monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
I'm standing right in front of the rig. I'm playing so light.
Yeah.
That's what allows the instrument to speak, the purpose, the why it was built.
Right.
You know, everybody's right hand has their own thing going on. Mm-hmm. It's unavoidable, and that's fine. But
would you consider yourself a player with a lighter touch?
Oh, yeah. Okay. You see me. My hands are barely moving. So
yeah,
and
I did notice
that.
You
get a really huge sound out of it, you know, if you have the right amount of headroom, which means a lot of power and a lot of speaker mass behind you. Without that, it's not that you're not playing the same game.
Right.
About volume, to be clear. It's just about having a lot of headroom so you can control dynamics with your right hand very carefully.
Right. To wrap up the gear portion of this, what bass do you have on the road with you for the G3 tour?
Well, I've got two Mike Lowells. I've got the PJ that mm-hmm. you saw in that video. And I've got the BBM F5, the one I just described, okay. The EMGs and the ebony fingerboard, the modern sounding one.
Yeah.
But then the third bass is a classic Fender made in Mexico Precision.
Nice.
And it's got most people think P and they think, oh, dark, warm, vintage. But Joe Satriani's demo bass is a 1973 P bass with a jazz neck on it that's got a maple fingerboard. So when he kind of gets on his like playing with a pick, it's like ching, 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 ching. There's an edge on it and it's bright.
Mm-hmm.
It's a classic pick bass sound, classic rock pick bass sound. So I don't really use a pick, but I realized that there were some songs in the last studio album that we did, The Elephants of Mars, that just needed that sound. The demo was clearly saying this is the bass sound.
Yeah.
So I went out and I got, with the help of my friends at Bananas at Large, a stock Fender Mexican P bass with a maple fingerboard. And I used that on the album and it worked great. And now I'm using it on tour. You know, P bass with a maple fingerboard, that's basically Steve Harris from Iron Maiden.
Yeah, okay.
That's where that ends up. And you can do that thing. But there's a lot more that you can do with it than just that.
Yeah, I have a PJ with a maple neck. Yeah. I like it. You know, it's a little bit different of a thing. And it...
Yeah.
It deals with the J portion of the PJ differently.
Right.
You know, that I appreciate. The Aristocrats. So you guys debuted at the NAMM show in 2011.
Right.
Had you guys already had a record kind of in the wings? Was it recorded or was this gig first, record second?
It's gig first, no plan anything after. It was just a pickup gig. A pickup gig at the NAMM show. And okay. Govan, our guitarist, was a fill-in for Greg Howe, who canceled about a month before the gig. So, I mean, Marco Miniman and Greg Howe and I had done a couple gigs in Russia. And we're like, okay, we're going to do it at the NAMM show. And then Greg couldn't do it. And we found Guthrie because, oh my God, what's his name? there's a guy on Facebook, Colin Green, who was messaging me and saying that there was this great guitarist, since I'd already played with Mike Keneally and Steve I and Deuce Zappa, you got to play with the world's next great guitarist. This is Guthrie Govan. Watch this video. And like, you know, I hadn't watched the video yet, but when Greg canceled, I was like, oh, watch this video. Maybe this guy. And then I was like,
that's so the guy. Yeah.
He came to NAMM and we did that show. And I've done NAMM gigs before, especially with like a collection of guys. I had never really seen an audience react like that audience. And so everybody afterwards was like, you're a band, right? What's the name of the band? We're like, we're not actually a band. Maybe we should be.
Yeah.
Here we are 12 years later as the Aristocrats.
Okay.
We're making our fifth studio album about to release now.
Nice. Fifth studio album titled Duck.
That's right.
Talk about the concept and then we'll talk about some of the music and then talk about the animation aspect to it.
Well, You know, we didn't go into it thinking it was going to be a concept album. We kind of backed into it. It was funny. Marco came in with the song called Sitting with a Duck on a Bay, which was, exactly. It was kind of a piss take on, like, you know, the Dock of the Bay.
Was there a nod to Otis Redding in the actual tune or just the title?
Well, yeah. The vibe of the tune is a bit of a 70s old school.
Okay.
And then, to make a long story shorter, later in the process, he came in with an addition to the end of another song called Duck's End. He was originally going to put it on that Otis Redding song, but he ended up putting it on a different song. And then I said, well, you know, if you've got something about Duck here, and then later in the album, you got another thing. I'm like, maybe we should just make the album called Duck. And Marco was like, that's funny. I woke up this morning thinking the same thing. And then I started filling in the blanks about what a duck story could be. Like, well, what's the story of this album? Who is this duck? And so I wrote a rough outline of a duck story. We all looked at it and kind of contributed different things to it. And next thing you know, we're like, yep, the album's called Duck. And we found an animator to animate this duck character for us. And there was a whole story that went along with it with Sergeant Rockhopper, which was a character that Guthrie had invented for the previous album we put out live in Europe, 2020, which is a picture of a police penguin on the front. That's Sergeant Rockhopper. And now we've got a duck. And we've got Sergeant Rockhopper the Penguin, and we have our protagonist and we have our antagonist. And, you know, the story that we came up with was, and again, we had to kind of look at the song titles, which already existed, and be like, well, instead of all these stories happening to us, which is why we write these songs, we said, what if it all happened to the duck? So we made up this story about how the duck lived on this quiet Antarctic island, but then he got in some trouble with some penguins there, got in a fight, and had to, like, flee the island because the police penguin was after him, was going to arrest him. So he jumped on a boat, ends up in New York City, way far away from home.
Yeah.
And considerable misadventures ensue.
That's hilarious.
So that's the story of the Duck album. And we're actually, like, still writing it right now, like the final version. Like, it's the one thing in the album that's not done. So we're going to publish it online, and we'll serialize it, publish it in little installments. Every song has a chapter.
Okay.
There's nine songs.
Okay. So nine chapters of the duck. Now, what's the duck's name? Is it just the duck?
It's D.D. Duck.
Okay. Okay.
That's his name. D.D. Duck.
That's hilarious. How did the animation component come to be? What made you guys want to make this also a visual?
Well, I mean, it would seem silly if we were going to have this album called Duck and there was a protagonist duck, and then there was
it would definitely be difficult to connect with.
I mean, like, you know, if we didn't make visuals for that, what are we doing? So it didn't even occur to us not to do it.
Okay.
You know,
then you got some animators that have some clout in the animation game.
We got this one guy named Lance Myers who had done a lot of work for a lot of different projects, but most notably had worked on the movie Space Jam.
Right.
I was like, wow, you know, so, and he's done a lot of famous gaming stuff too, but I'm not a gamer, so I don't know stuff. But yeah, and we had tried out a couple of different artists. We had a couple of different draft ducks that weren't quite what we were looking for in our duck.
That's hilarious.
So finally, that guy showed up, and then his duck showed up, and we're like, that's the duck.
That's the duck.
Duck right there.
How has playing with this group for so long changed your playing? Has it changed your playing?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it's improved it for sure. I mean, Marco and Guthrie are both what I would call extended technique players. Mm-hmm. These are guys who started when they were 3 years old and were full on practicing all the time, pushing the limits of their instrument. By the time they were 18, they'd already been practicing for 13 years, like hard.
Right.
And so, and they were extraordinarily talented to go along with their work ethic. I have some talents. My ears are good. My hands are okay. But I did not have an extraordinary work ethic before the age of 18. I had my own little way of doing things. So, and I was going to be in like a blues rock band. I like playing like soul and R&B and
really
earthy stuff.
Yeah.
So when I got my first gig with Dweezil Zappa, it was a shock to me. Like, oh, okay, this is a great opportunity. I'm going to take it. But like, I haven't really completely trained for this wild technical stuff. So right. I've been kind of catching up ever since. And when I joined the Aristocrats, I thought I had caught up to having played with Steve Vai and Mike Keneally and all those people. But turns out that my journey was just beginning in that, because Marco and Guthrie both think so fast. So, I mean, I listened back to the first album and I'm just like, oh, you know, like you know, there's so much different I would do now. I think everybody probably feels like that to a certain extent, but I know I did. Sure. Now I feel like after 10 years of playing with Marco and Guthrie, they think so fast. I've had to train myself to think faster.
Mm.
Not really about the hands. You can get there, but it's the thinking. It's the mental thing.
That's right.
They broadened my horizons on what's possible in the moment, improvisationally, and they've changed the way I think about compositions and approaching the instrument. And I think like any great collaboration, you know, it's greater than the sum of the parts. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm sure I have attributes that have, you know, contributed to Guthrie's and Marco's growth, and Marco has attributes that have contributed to the two of ours, and Guthrie has to that. That's the way a great group functions, you know?
That's right, yeah.
But yes, I've really had to catch up. And with Guthrie in particular, you know, he sends me these demos and like, he's playing these parts on bass, and it's very humbling. He's a really good bass player. And, you know, and he doesn't sound maybe like a traditional bass player, but like, he doesn't sound like a guitarist just hacking shit out on bass. Mm-hmm. He can play bass.
Right.
And the parts that he writes are really complicated. That's the trademark Guthrie thing, is that, you know, when there's a super active bass line, that it's a Guthrie song.
Okay.
So anyway, yeah, they've definitely pushed and improved my playing for sure.
How have those characteristics that have you've grown from playing with the Aristocrats, how has that impacted your sideman work with tours like what you're on? Like being able to think fast, but it's differently because you're not necessarily on the similar wavelength as the Aristocrats guys.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, as my Australian friend in Joe Satriani's band, Ray Thistlethwaite, likes to say, it's horses for courses, you know. You really want to apply the thing that works for the gig.
Mm-hmm.
And so what works for the Aristocrats doesn't necessarily work for Joe Satriani. Very, very different artistries at work there. And with Joe, it's always about making sure that the tone is absolutely spot on. The groove is really consistent. And I'm only playing enough so that the guitar melody can speak. And then when there's a moment to actually open up and get wild, but like, okay. You know, it's not like the Aristocrats where we're like in fourth and fifth gear a lot of the time.
Right. Yeah, it's not a group project, obviously. It's Joe Satriani.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. We're there to support his artistry and set a foundation so that he can fly free.
Mm-hmm. And playing with so many guitar players of that style, Vi and now Eric Johnson too, and Satriani, do you find that you have to switch your concept per guitar player, or does the same concept kind of apply to that style regularly?
Well, tonally, you have to be careful. I found that that red bright bass that I like to use with the Aristocrats and my Keneally didn't really want to play nice with Joe Satriani's basic driven guitar sound. I had to put it away. And once I did and I picked up different instruments, everything worked better.
Okay.
And, you know, that's different. So different sounds work differently with different sounds, you know. So what works with the Aristocrats is kind of a per song basis because we're doing so many different genres and pastiches. With Vi, I felt like that red bass worked really well, but there's other things that maybe I would have wanted to revisit. I mean, I haven't played live on his gig since 2007. So I think the answer to your question is I have some innate characteristics in my playing that are probably always there. I hope so anyway. But I'm always thinking song first. Mm-hmm. And I'm always thinking appropriate tone, like, is very, very, very important. What makes the overall band, and especially working with your specific guitar artist, if it's going to be a guitarist, what works best with that?
Have any of the guitar artists given you notes or feedback about the instrument or signal chain you have? Or is it kind of you're doing your own self-editing?
Well, you know, a lot of the times they're so busy on their own trip, they just don't have the bandwidth to kind of drill down into your thing. Sure. And if you're doing your job right, they don't have to.
Absolutely.
Some artists, though, can be very detailed. Like Steve Vai, there was a moment where he was just like, hey, what's going on with this high-end frequency? I want to zero in on that. And he was right. It was kind of something was clashing around like 2.5, 3K, and we had to deal with it. But, you know, on the gig, generally, everybody's kind of trying to make sure their own monitoring world is okay. And ideally, you've worked out all the tone stuff in rehearsal. And if you were making the album together, then you already know what songs, sounds came together easily in mix. Right. What songs, when you went to mix them, were weird because two different sounds were clashing and you had to kind of work around it.
Sure.
So there's a lot going on there with that answer.
Yeah, no, all good, all good. I know you got to go. So let's, the Aristocrats album, A Duck.
Duck, yes.
Is going
coming
to
out
be
on February 16th.
50, all the platforms.
Actually,
not all the platforms.
We're going to be releasing it. I'm going to post a little video about this soon. We're going to release it and reward our most loyal fans who support us in the traditional fashion first.
Cool.
On CD and vinyl and high-res digital download through Bandcamp. And, of course, if you purchase a digital download from Bandcamp, you can stream all you like on the Bandcamp app. So it's like having it wherever you go.
Sure.
And, you know, because we live in the modern world where streaming services are a real thing, eventually we will release on streaming services. And then people who feel that that's the only place they want to listen to music, it will arrive there in a couple of months.
Okay, but Bandcamp first.
Bandcamp and all physical media. And it's available, you know, I mean, you'll find it on Amazon if you like, but, you know, the best way to support us is to go directly to our web stores, which are all available from our website at the-aristocrats-band.com.
Killing. Brian, thanks so much for taking the time to do this, man.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Man, anytime, you got any new news, hit me up. Come back on, please.
Okay, yeah, I will.
Maybe if we, it'd be nice to talk when, you know, we have a little bit more time and I don't mess up the audio.
Oh, it's okay. I mean, you know, the tone thing, I could go on and on and on forever, but.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about it, man.
Yeah, it's just something I worked on for a really long time.
That's killer.
I feel like it's a missing ingredient in so many educational environments. You know, everybody's teaching you scales, arpeggios, soloing, you know, this, that. It's like, who's teaching you how to set up a rig so that it works great with a band?
Yeah, and signal chain and like what order you're running things in on your pedal board, stuff like that. I mean, so there's so much focus on what your left hand is doing.
It's like, all really, yeah, that's right.
And
it's
so much, really, so many other things get thrown by the wayside, including right hand technique and warm-ups and, you know, things that are necessary to keep it all working.
Yeah, I always feel bad for people who kind of like are developing some kind of problem because it means that they just kind of learn the wrong way.
Sure.
And they're playing too tense. You know, it doesn't have to be that way.
Quickly, have you ever dealt with any medical issues related to either hand?
Never.
Tendonitis? Okay,
never.
Great.
Never.
Great. What do you do as like a warm up to maintain hand health?
Nothing.
Okay. You just learned properly as a self starter.
Well, what I just always try to make sure that there was always enough headroom and volume in my world so that I never had to play hard.
Right.
Because once you start doing that, everything goes wrong.
Yeah, that's true. The sound and your
health. That's right. Yeah, it's all bad. Right. All bad.
Yeah. Cool, man. Brian, thanks so much. We'll be in touch, man.
All right. Thank you. Okay, cheers.
Yo, 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 this is Craig Gash. Subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on the Instagram and the YouTube. Leave us a comment.
I just stubbed my toe!
I think that's funny every time I hear it. that was my talk with Brian Beller. That was great, man. The episode got cut short because he had somewhere to be. I think we started a little late or something that had been recorded a few weeks back. But I can't wait to have him back. I can't wait to have him back on the podcast to talk more. There's a couple times he mentioned that we didn't have enough time to get into something. And next time around, I hope we have enough time. Because I would like to see where that conversation goes, and I would like to hear his thoughts on those topics. I loved listening to him talk about gear, the detail in which he just explained the basses. Again, check out the new album titled Duck by the Aristocrats. Stop by their website, the-aristocrats-band.com. Stop by, see what's going on, get more information about the album. And yeah, folks, that's about all I got. That's about all I got for this one. I'll catch you on the next one in a minute.